And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. Patty Quattro, it is season three of the Rock and Roll Survivors podcast, and it's all things, all pleasure seekers, starting from mid-1964. You're all-female, groundbreaking rock and roll band. So hello, my friend. How are you, my podcast partner in crime?
Oh, I'm feeling good here. I'm ready to go. Let's drive this car.
Foot on the gas, as you would say. Well, as we are diving in, and we are really going to take our time with your incredible stories and this history that's taking place in Detroit. For our loyal listeners, first of all, thank you so much for taking the time to spend season one and two with us, because it was really important to set the stage of how the Quattro sisters and your brother, Michael Quattro, all came about in the basically late 50s for your brother, but early 60s to mid 60s for your sisters in Detroit, at a time that was pivotal for the city, pivotal for the country. Cultural shifts were happening. And I think in order to understand the importance of you and what you were doing with your sisters at this time, was season two especially was all about your family, your father and his musical talents, about your sister Susie on the bongos, about you taking piano lessons and vocal lessons with your other sisters, Nancy and Arlene, your brother on Lawrence Welk, and setting the stage of how the Pleasure Seekers came about, including your epiphany, which we're going to talk about again, at the Beatles. But I just want to say hello to you, Patty, and get your reflections on where we've been, where we're going this season, and just hello.
Hello, hello. There's so much, you know, when you mention Detroit and its cultural significance and all that, it blows my mind, because for me, Detroit is the Motor City, magic, Motown, music, and mayhem. I mean, it just flows. You know, it's a city of extremes, and that's what we lived. Yeah, I mean, you know, it had the rich, the poor, the white, the black, the rock and soul. It had all of it. And Detroiters are the epitome of surviving. That's the thing about Detroit. It's been up and down, as you know, through history so many times. And there's like a desperation of people that live there, Detroiters, to survive. to figure it out, to figure out an escape from what a lot of them ended up in the factories and stuff. But it's all we had. So us teenagers had our foot on the gas full throttle. You know, it was a way to make something different for our lives when I was living there and growing up in that kind of a scene.
Well, and I think that's so important. And I am fortunate enough to say that I too am now a Detroiter, even though I
Yes.
was born and raised in Los Angeles. I moved here a couple months ago, and I have been traveling all through your old haunts, which I can't wait to explore and talk about. But it is interesting because you're talking about the toughness and the tenacity of Detroiters. And I think there is something to that grit. And as you said, there is something about trying to make something better of yourself and of your life. But I also think, and we've touched upon this before, and I will say it ad nauseum, there is something magical in the water of Detroit because you might be trying to build yourself up out, with your bootstraps or get out of a certain industry like the car industry or whatever it is. But there is that hope and that creativity and that magic that happens in order to get yourself out of a situation you may not like.
You know, it's funny because I have to credit that in a way to the history. I mean, you know, the immigrants in the US, to just broaden it a little bit. They come through New York, Ellis Island, and they're having their names shortened, and they go to different states to find jobs, whether it was the South, the coal mines, wherever they went. And somehow Detroit became this beacon in the US. You know the reputation of Detroit all through the decades, and people flew went there. The Motor City blew up, and it made Detroit something very important for people to find another job. They were desperate to make their new life in America. So there they came, and they built up a magical city that didn't happen anywhere else in the US.
I think what you're saying is so important. And yet, at the same time, they held on to their own unique cultural roots within the city of Detroit. So you have Jack White, who was once Jack Gillis from the White Stripes. He grew up in Mexican Town, which is 2 miles from me. I mean, and or you have Greek Town, or you have whatever it is, but it's all part of Detroit. And there's not necessarily an isolation to it per se. It's a celebration of each culture, and yet the larger canvas is Viva la Detroit. I mean, people are so fanatical here about the city and its hopes and its aspirations and what's happening. It feels like a renaissance. I love
You
being.
know, and it was like that, you know, it was like that in New York, all the different nationalities, but Detroit became different because of the music and all that. You had all these little neighborhoods that you mentioned, but we all came together and jammed and stuff. And that was where you had the magic start happening in the music arena because everybody was jamming with each other, like from the greaser to the frats, the rich of Grosse Pointe and the, you know, different sections of the city. But we all jammed and played all the different teen clubs. So it started mixing and mixing that magic that happened with the music in a lot of ways. And we all got along. It wasn't like these nationalities didn't get along. They were just in little pockets of the city with the central downtown. So it was amazing how it grew up. Very unusual in
Grew
the
up
U.S.
and it was so organic to the city.
Yes.
And we'll talk about the suburb of Grosse Pointe, which is where you and your family grew up. And yet I also think there's so many dichotomies that we want to explore in this season. And there's also so many pillars. The car industry, as you talked about, the civil unrest, the British invasion, how you came about to form the pleasure seekers within all of this. But there is something so unique about not only Detroit, but Grosse Pointe and these other pockets, as you said, because there wasn't necessarily a challenge coming from each cultural pocket. It was, I mean, to use a horrible cliche, it was truly a melting pot of music, of rock and roll that was coming together.
Exactly. It was a melting pot because every nationality had their way of playing and the groups they liked and all that. Because there was a lot of music going on, which we'll get to, you know, a lot of labels and different things. It wasn't just Motown. So we'll get to that in depth. But that's what happened. I mean, they all melded together and learned from each other. So it was magic. I'm
Well, one of
telling you.
the One of the things I've learned so much from you in both seasons, but in season two, especially because it's your family and the history, but I think it bears repeating, is that the rise of rock and roll in the early 60s, or R&B to rock and roll in the early 60s in Detroit to the mid 60s with the British invasion, was not a challenge or a rivalry or a rebellion of Motown. It was
No.
happening parallel. It was almost side by side, and both were fueled, to use a really bad pun, by the rise and the success of the car industry. But also at a certain point, your generation, and I was just reading about Ray Parker Jr., who's another Detroiter, who his father really wanted him to go into the car industry, and he said, absolutely not, I want to go into music. And so many of your, as you call them, homeboys were of this generation who did not want to go into the car industry. They wanted something different. They had this grit, and in this case, it was gritty rock and roll. So I'd love your thoughts on that, especially being a woman coming up, because your father would have never pushed you to go into the car industry.
No, I mean, he was playing da-di-da music. And Arlene was going crazy watching TV, seeing Elvis screaming. And we were young kids. I mean, what? We were probably 13 and 11 or whatever. And then Susie was playing her little bongos with Dad. And the Guitar Army was forming in Detroit. They're known for it. It's the only city, the Guitar Army, the MC5, all the guitarists, Ted Nugent. So you had that bubbling up. You're talking about the crossover here. It's interesting because we came out of the doo-wop era and Elvis came in and you had Dion and Del Shannon and all these pop type people. And then you also had a lot of black vocal groups, the girly groups and people, already bubbling up, and you had the labels and stuff happening. So there was a crossover from like the my dad's horny music to, big band stuff, which I love the big band stuff, but into the doo-wop and then into pop. And then came the rock. The British invasion heralded that in heavily, even though it was bubbling a little, but you had more pop music that was popular that I was listening to from like 1959 to 63. I was a folkie. I was into Peter, Paul, and Mary. Nobody else, but I liked it. And when we hung with some of the homeboys, the local musicians, we would go to those concerts, but they were experimenting already with playing rock. You hear the rumors of the Beatles, this English thing. Hadn't happened yet, but it was coming.
Well,
That
and
was.
I think it is so unique to the Quattro family and the support of your dad and your mom, even though she was behind the scenes, that the female sisters would wrap their heads around exploring rock and roll, especially in the what, late 50s to early 60s. That was, you were going to be housewives. You were going to have a few career choices, maybe a teacher until you got married, secretary. There weren't a lot of avenues for you. And so to even say, let's get into this music thing, it wasn't as a groupie, it wasn't as a fan. And also, you weren't just fronting it with male guys behind you and Svengali's like a Berry Gordy
Yeah.
telling you what to do. And that is absolutely not to discount any of the wonderful, wonderful female bands at Motown. But again, what was happening in Detroit was almost unlimited. It was not about gender. It was not about what you look like. It was not about tokenizing. It was really good music, whether Peter, Paul, and Mary, all the way to rock.
Yeah. I mean, I started on folk. Susie, while Arlene was screaming about Elvis, Susie was already playing her bongos with Dad, at 6 or 8 years old. And she looked at her sister screaming and said, and my dad said, "Turn that off," because he was too sexy, Elvis. He said, "Turn that off. It's disgusting." And then he came home with an Elvis record later. He said, "I guess he's a good singer." But Susie was watching her sister and going, "I want to be him." It hit her psychology. Now, none of us were playing music, fiddling around, whatever, but we weren't in a band or anything. We were just young teenagers in junior high taking vocal lessons with our choir teacher. My dad hired him to teach us privately. So Dad was pushing, trying to format a little bit of his daughter's love of music, his passion. But we weren't involved in it in any real way yet. We were just listening to the popular music, going to school. That was it in those early years.
Well, I want to pull back the curtain a little bit on those early years, and we are again going to be talking about this all season long. But you just said something that I want to clarify a little bit. And the reason why I want to clarify this is, let me just set the stage, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. But you just said, Susie, you all were watching Elvis, and Susie said, I want that because of the response from the audience, or because she wanted to play rock and roll. What do you think that was? Because, and that goes to my main impetus to have you explore with me all things Pleasure Seekers, and then season four is going to be all things Cradle, is with social media now and with other people that you've worked with who have already gotten to tell their stories or and highlight their narrative or push a certain narrative. I really wanted this to be your time. I loved the three oral histories that you and I did together about your 60 plus years in rock and roll. And it really got me thinking that your story is important. You were the one who founded the Pleasure Seekers.
Yes.
You were 16 years old, and this all happened in 1964. So before we move on, clarify for me about Susie. Is that the response? She liked the response the audience was giving him?
It was sexual for her, as young as she was, and she had to be quite young. It just hit her in a sexual way, and she thought it was very, when Dad said, "Oh, turn that off, that's disgusting," that hit her, and it just grabbed her. She said, "I'm going to be him." That's what she said to herself. So something hit her psychologically. And Susie's the entertainer of the family. She's like Dad. So that thought hit her, even though she wasn't doing anything but playing bongos in her dad's band. That's it. That's how it hit her.
Well, again, we're going to explore all of these early seeds in more depth, but I wanted to give just a little bit for our listeners who may not know this, that Pleasure Seekers and then Cradle were inducted in 2012 into the Detroit Music Awards at the Fillmore East. Am I right? Is that the name, the correct name? Fillmore East.
Fillmore. I don't know if it's
Fillmore.
Fillmore East, but it's the Fillmore Theater. It's gorgeous. Oh my God.
And we're going to be playing some music from your time, whether it was played live or some things, surprises that we have up our sleeves. But as we're setting the stage and pulling the curtain back to talk about all of this, you mentioned the MC5 in our seasons one and seasons two. We talked about your homeboys and who you played with. And one of the things that I think is also important, besides that this is your story, Patty Quatro, and I want this to be your narrative, is that when you were playing with your homeboys, you all were really exchanging musical ideas and licks, and however you want to word it, it was a moment where magic was being created. You were not on the outside of this. You were on the inside. You played bills with them, and we will share that with our listeners. You recorded with the MC5 at the Hideout. There were tapes there that were going to play together. So I just want to read you very quickly when you were inducted, you and your sisters, the bands, into the Detroit Music Awards at the Fillmore. This is what Dennis Machine Gun Thompson from the MC5 wrote about you and the Pleasure Seekers and the band and your sisters. Quote, "The Quatro Girls were the first all-female band that played instruments well, and forerunners for many bands to follow. One kick-ass band." Close quote. There's so many things I could just tease out in that one sentence alone. First of all, it's Dennis Machine Gun Thompson from the MC5. May he rest in peace, or may he rest in power, brother. But I love it underscores what I was trying to say before, which is, sure, these straight guys who, when they were straight, would of course try to hit on you because you guys were hot, but that went away very quickly
Clearly.
because of how good you played. And for him to say you were the first all-female band that played instruments well, I think is a really important point, because you weren't the first female all-female band. You were one of the first. You were signed in late 1964 to a record label, but what he was getting at is this was no longer the token girl band. You could play instruments well.
Yes. And of course, all the homeboys, there were different ones and different bands that hit on us. We had a good looking band, but I say it all the time. They respected the band from the get-go. Somehow, when we did, finally get together and all the things that happened to the first record and all that, we could play and we did play and they respected it. I mean, our album was done with the MC5 on New Year's Eve on a two-track. I mean, come on, so many gigs that were done.
And clearly, so much respect.
They were great. They always respected us. I love those guys. And they were so into the music. It's not like they weren't hitting on us specifically. When they spoke about us, even in the press and stuff, they said good stuff. We were friends and colleagues, and they were great. I loved playing gigs with them because it was about the music.
And I think that's so important. That's definitely going to be another theme for us throughout the season. It was about the music. It was not about the fame. The fame may have come from it, but it was to create really good music. So one of the other things that I really want to pick up on that Dennis Machine Gun Thompson said was he opened it up with the Quattro Girls, right? So that underscores that he's, yes, there were other members in the band that were not your sisters, but he's talking about the Quattro Girls. And I recently, I grew up with Owen Elliott, who was the daughter of Cass Elliott, and I recently read her memoir called My Mama Cass. And for those who haven't read it, it's phenomenal. And speaking of owning the narrative, she wanted to tell the story about her mom, her time with her until she was 7 years old when her mom passed away. But there was something that she said about her mom and her sister Leah, who also just passed away, because Leah was a songwriter and a singer as well. And if anybody knows Cass Elliott's voice, which was phenomenal, her sister Leah sounded a lot like her. And so Elliot, I mean, excuse me, Owen Elliott was talking about the nuance that sisters have that can't be replicated in any other setting. And it immediately made me think of you. And so I'm going to read it and then I would love your response. So the quote is, quote, "Gathering together around the piano," and she's talking about her mom and her aunt and family, "gathering together around the piano, listening to music and singing along was something that my mom and aunt did frequently as a family. My aunt Leah remembers singing the Patience and Prudence song, 'Tonight You Belong to Me,' with my mom when they were about 9 and 16. Though I never got to hear them sing together, I can imagine how magical they must have sounded. When people of the same genetic origin sing together, they create a perfect blend unlike any other. There is often a certain similarity to those voices. Musical history has given us example of this in the Lennon sisters, the sisters known as Hart, Ann and Nancy Wilson, and Carney and Wendy Wilson of Wilson Phillips, excuse me. And then she ends with, "Families just sound great together," close quote. And as I said, Patty, you should be added to this list because the Quattro sisters have this harmonic blend that is so unique because you are sisters. And you spoke about that in season two, but I want you to talk about it again, how it could be 40 years later and you could pick up a tune and the Quattro girls would sing exactly your parts. So talk to us about that.
Well, we did that all through the decades. One of the songs we used to do is Sweet Judy Blue Eyes with all the harmonies. And decades later, we would be on a home visit or something and just go to our parts naturally, even after decades. You really explained it pretty well. It's a tonal quality, it's DNA, it's genetics. There's something about the blend when you're singing together. And don't forget, my father nurtured that. He did all the sing-alongs in the living room, and we would gather around and sing. So there's a history of that that we got. But yeah, we could blend. And Susie, go figure. Susie had like a low voice, like Joplin-y, and Nancy could wail like Robert Plant. I was in the middle, so we knew when we were learning a song exactly which part to go to. Susie was going to go to the alto, Sometimes I did soprano, Nancy in the middle. I mean, we all just knew where our parts would be without even thinking about it. And regular bands, you're figuring out, well, I'll sing this part, I'll sing this. We didn't do that. We just sort of knew we could hear the harmonies because we were musically inclined, and we just would start singing it in our parts. So, yeah, it was pretty magical and unusual. And that was something we had extra in the bucket of advantages, I guess you'd say, that familial blend. Can't
Well,
explain.
that was Owen Elliott, and I don't want to take credit for that thought because she really observed that. And again, I've observed it listening to you and your sisters sing. And in fact, Owen Elliott went on to say there was a moment, this is in her book, where the Carney and Wendy Wilson and Chyna Phillips and Owen Elliott, so think of their musical history and their legacies and who their parents were going to do a four-part
Right.
band. And Owen talks about the difficulties of which part are you going to take? How are you going? And that speaks to what you were saying, Patty, which is because they weren't raised together. They don't share the same DNA. They might be best of friends, but there is a familial aspect to that knowledge without having to talk about it. It's almost psychic, if you will.
And the interesting thing is, when we had the other girls in the band, Darlene was quite a fabulous singer. But it was a different thing. I mean, the three sisters, we would automatically know what we were going to sing, and then we had to fit in the others. Pammy didn't sing a lot. Different people we had in different times. Eileen sang a bit because we were all in choir at high school. But the three of us always knew where we were going with the songs we were learning. And Darlene just was able, we gave her a part, she would go to it. So they could do it. But ours was more natural, what we were going to. It's just the way it worked.
With all the lonely people.